hath given them. Thus did your fathers when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up into the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the children of Israel that they should not go into the land which the Lord had given them. And the Lord's anger was kindled the same time. And so he is basically reciting or reiterating what had happened earlier, and is concerned that the action on the part of these two tribes particularly would excite the Lord again to be angry with the whole nation of Israel. They come up with a solution. The solution is, verse 16, they came near to him and said, "We will build sheepfolds here for our cattle, or in cities for our little ones. But we ourselves will go ready, armed before the children of Israel, until we have brought them into their place, and our little ones shall dwell in the fenced cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return unto our houses until the children of Israel have inherited every man his inheritance. For we will not inherit with them on yonder side Jordan or forward, because our inheritance is fallen to us on this side Jordan eastward." And Moses said unto them, "If you will do this thing, if you will go armed before the Lord to war." Twice he raises the specter of good intentions, but the possibility of not following through. "If," he says, "if you will go armed before the Lord to war, and will go all of you armed over Jordan before the Lord, until he hath driven out his enemies from before him, and the land be subdued before the Lord, then afterward you shall return." Now it's in that context that Moses makes the statement. "But if you will not do so, if for some reason you return too early, if you return or turn in the middle of battle, if you just simply change your mind and after you build your cities and build your places for your livestock, you decide, well, you don't want to go. Under those circumstances," he says, "you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out." Now, certainly, the primary application is very narrow to these 2.5 tribes. But the principle is universal. And it covers dispensation upon dispensation to our present day. You may take it the same as I, that if we sin, it will find us out. If we sin, it will find us out. A man, I don't have any idea who the fellow is, particularly Dr. South, in one of the Treasury Knowledge commentaries, made this observation. Very crystal clear to me. He says, he mentions two primary motives by which men and women are either induced to sin or seduced by sin. Two primary motives. And he says, usually the heart, the individual heart, seems overpowered by either the illusion of secrecy in committing sin, or an imagined impunity with respect to consequence. Now think about that for a minute. And it makes fairly good sense. It's scriptural that whenever a person sins, particularly those who have a background in or a knowledge of the omniscient God, have to essentially discount their theology in order to sanction their sin. So there is an illusion of secrecy. If no one else in the world knows I did it, I can pretty much get away with it and be exempt from any consequence that may fall through. But the scriptures say, be sure your sin will find you out. And, you know, the reality of all of this is that no matter how adept the concealment of sin with respect to the time that lapses between the deed and the discovery of the deed, there is, and you can underline a statement, there is absolutely no statute of limitations on sin in the eyes of God. However there may be in the legal system, there is no statute of limitation with respect to sin. I'll give you a couple of things to think about from the scriptures. Go to Genesis chapter 4 quickly to verse number 7. And with respect to Cain, verse number 7, his offering was not qualitatively viewed by God to be the same as his brother's. And so this statement is made. If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. Sin lieth at the door. And the sense of that phrase is best viewed from a word picture that sees a predator hiding, concealed, ready to pounce on its victim. Sin lies ready to pounce in that circumstance. Well, let me have you remember this also. Also in Genesis chapter 44, with regard to Joseph's brothers. Be sure your sin will find you out. Genesis 44 and verse 16. They're in the process of having their sin discovered. Verse 16, Judah said, what shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? How shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of his servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also with whom the cup is found. All of a sudden dawned on them that what they had tried to conceal, first of all, from their father in the beginning, was being discovered now after a period of time. Remember, there's no statute of limitations on a lie. None. None. There's no way to outdistance the sin. Joseph's brothers would find that out. Then there's this to be considered. Look in Psalm 90. Psalm 90. And verse number 8. The truth of the matter is, man essentially becomes as a fool when he sins, because in a sense he is saying, I'll catch God while he's blinking. Because I really don't think that any Christian in their right mind, I don't believe any Christian in their right mind would flat out sin knowing that God was watching them do it. I don't believe that. But it may be that there's you could plead temporary insanity. Maybe God has his eyes shut. Maybe he blinked. Maybe he turned his head just for a second and didn't see. So here in Psalm 90, in verse 8, thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. Now, if it be that for myself or for you, that there are sins that you're concealing, or sin that you're concealing, and it's been some time since the deed, so much time has passed that you figure, well, it's all but forgotten. It hasn't. Be sure your sin will find you out. Now, what then ought we ought to, what should do? Go back to Psalm 19, verse 12. Psalm 19, verse 12. Who can understand his errors? Then the prayer request. Cleanse thou me from secret faults. Cleanse thou me from secret... How does that happen? Well, for the the child of God, confession is the avenue by which sin is cleansed instead of being concealed. Because you see, the concealing of sin brings with it a whole lot of unnecessary baggage that for the life of the time between the deed and discovery, one carries it with them. The conscience is weighed down. And there's a lot of bad things that happen physically, spiritually, and emotionally to a person trying to cover the sin. So the prayer request is, cleanse thou me from secret faults. But then we say, one might be tempted to think, well, look, how extensive must this be? I mean, how concerned is God really over this kind of thing? I was reading this morning in devotions, and I came across Numbers chapter 13, or pardon me, Deuteronomy chapter 13, and the 17th verse. Deuteronomy 13 and the 17th verse. And one word in the 17th verse caught my mind. I looked into it just a little bit. And when I did that, another raft of verses flooded my heart. In verse 17, of course, the warning is, don't let any of your friends talk you in to worshiping an idol. That's the general gist. And verse 17 says, and there shall cleave not, N-O-U-G-H-T, not, of the cursed thing to thine hand, that the Lord may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show thee mercy and have compassion upon thee and multiply thee as he hath sworn unto thy fathers. I think everybody's would be pretty well satisfied with the straightforward application of the word not as being equivalent to the word nothing, except that when you dig down just a little bit below the surface, it has in mind the idea of a speck, a tiny little speck, just a little point that is visible, but not all that compelling. And so when we read that again, there shall cleave not even a speck of the cursed thing. Not even a speck of it. And so again, we dredge up that question from previous Bible studies, how holy is holy? How holy is too holy? How holy does God want us to be? What qualifies as holy in the eyes of God? And so, Lord, cleanse thou me from secret faults, even the speck of sin. But then somebody would say, I've been watching so and so and so and so for a long time, and you know, I think from what we heard tonight, they should really be under conviction. If they were listening to what Pastor said tonight, they should really be under conviction. You know, I feel bad for them, I really do. But then I come to New Testament truth, and I look into Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. I think we were talking about this first verse last week. Matthew 7. Judge not that ye be not judged. Then it goes on, for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure you meet, it shall be measured to you again. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Now the mote there would be like unto a splinter. Literally a straw, a small speck of a straw that you might that might be so tiny as that if you're out in a brisk wind in a field, it blow up in your eye and cause an irritation. Weighed in contrast to the beam, the timber, the 2x4 that's in the other person's eye. And it is the hypocrite who's walking around with a 2x4 sticking out of his eye, so to speak, who is generally the first person to point out the splinter in the brother's eye. But you know, whether it is a 2x4 or whether it is a splinter, if it's sin, even a speck of sin that is being concealed, it's very painful to have it exposed. Very painful. Now, look in John chapter 8. Because before, we'll apply verse number 7 to Matthew 7 verse 1, judge not. Except in this case, when you go about to judge, make sure you bring your bag of stones. Bring your bag of stones. In John chapter 8 is that account where the skeptics or the critics of the Lord set him up with this woman taken in adultery. And he says in verse 7, so when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, he that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. So we'll play off verse 7 with Matthew 7, verse 1. And when we think about this matter of secrets and stones and specks and splinters, it is underscored by the universal truth in Numbers 32. Be sure your sin will find you out. Now, if you happen to be the person who exposes the sin, the counsel in all humility should be bring your stones. Bring your stones. Make sure that the 2x4 is extracted from your own life before you set about to deal with the speck in the eye of another person. Now, I say all that to say this without getting into any detail whatever. Sooner or later, you are about to hear of a large, long-standing scandal that's taken place in fundamentalist Baptist churches. Don't put this out on the wire if it's